Yep, I thought it was
You are in for a treat. The former CEO and chairman of Blockbuster, which some people may not know this. In fact, I think it's the first time I just thought about it. I used to work at Blockbuster in Canada, and it was my first job, I think, my second job. First guy was gas station, and it was my best job of all time. And today we have the former CEO chairman, also involved all tons of companies. Welcome to the JT Fox Podcast, that network. On this show, we interview some of the biggest names in the world, A-list celebrities, major CEOs, legends, titans, and goats. But this is an interview that I think will be one of our better ones, just for the fact that I, by accident, someone sent me his video. He had done five or six. So this is not someone that's on social media. And also his new book, The Education, Is Freedom. And I'm excited. Welcome to Jim Keys to the show. How are you?
Thanks. I'm great. I didn't realize you were a Blockbuster
Well,
alum.
it was in Toronto, and actually, no, I actually had a job in Montreal first at Blockbuster. And two things I liked about that job. Number one, the free movies. That was the thing. And I was like a stutterer, and so I wasn't very good. So sometimes they put me on the floor to talk to the customers or put the VHS
Yeah.
and then the DVDs eventually in the back.
You
And
cut a
then
free
I was on
line.
that counter. But the biggest problem there was the theft. I saw a lot of staff steal stuff, to be
You can
honest.
save
Yeah,
yourself
like,
a deal. Come on.
I know it's the biggest reach off that, but you know what? It was so fun, and it's interesting because such an iconic brand. But let's just jump into it right away.
Sure.
Did Blockbuster fail because they failed to innovate like Netflix?
No.
Okay.
Simple answer. This is the best kept secret. And what when did you leave
Oh,
Blockbuster?
I was like
You had to
that
be early,
20
right?
years ago. It was 20 years
Yeah,
ago.
pre-me. But there are so many misunderstandings about Blockbuster. But the first is that they didn't keep up with digital, that they were slow to respond to Netflix, et cetera, et cetera. Not true. Blockbuster had something called Blockbuster On Demand. In fact, my first action in 2007, when I arrived at the company, was to buy a streaming movie company, and it was the premier streaming movie company in the industry at the time. Now, didn't mean much because people really weren't streaming in 2007, but the studios had five of the six studios. So Sony, Warner, Paramount, they all got together and they created a streaming video entity so that you wouldn't have what you have today, which is chaos. You never know. It's not like the Blockbuster store where I know I'll get anything I want to see, new movie, old movie, TV show.
Except a new movie that come out, and then what happened is everybody's trying to go, and everyone's looking behind to see if the box is there, and then they would waiting by the box when someone do the returns. You know,
Yeah.
I worked at Blockbuster,
Oh
but
yeah, exactly. But
right?
I don't know if you do you remember what that was called? I was shocked when I got to Blockbuster. That was actually by design, believe it or not.
Which one?
Because back in the day, 100 years ago, not really 100, Blockbuster used to short the stores the number of new releases
No
on
way.
purpose.
So people come there and see and come back.
Yeah,
Now they would rent something
yeah.
else because no one's coming just for that movie.
Yeah, exactly. But when I got there in 2007, of course, Netflix is already doing DVDs by mail. Blockbuster was doing DVDs by mail, but they still had this goofy practice of shorting the stores so to try to force customers to come back. Well, I grew up in 7-Eleven. I grew up in the convenience industry. Convenience movies are all about convenience, media access. It wasn't really a stretch for me, but it was shocking that we were making it inconvenient for the customer to see their favorite new release, trying to get them back into the store. That's the opposite of convenience. When we actually fixed that, we dramatically improved the sales and profits at store level, which allowed us then to put money back into digital.
So the story of Netflix says that they went in Reed Hastings, they offered Block, but they wanted $50 million. They turned him down. And is that one of those like for example, when they say Apple started in a garage, and Apple co-founder said to me, Steve Wozniak, "No, we stored boxes. Like we never worked at the garage, right?" Is that an urban myth, or that legitimately happened? And were you part of that meeting?
No, I wasn't part of the meeting, and it's not an urban myth. At least I've heard Mark Randolph in a speech that he gave reference a meeting that he had in the year 2000. That's the action item. The year 2000, they did. He said he and Reed Hastings approached John Aniakko, my predecessor, and offered up Netflix for $50 million. I can't confirm whether that was true or not. I wasn't there. But, you know, it's easy to, in hindsight today, go, well, that was a stupid move. Look at the market cap. But that was 2000. So that was 23 years ago. And 23 years ago, Netflix had DVDs by mail, barely. Same thing Blockbuster built on their own. They didn't really need Netflix. So it really wasn't a very bad decision, even though it's easy today for people.
$50 million back then is a lot of money. But would you say that
a lot of money.
That,
yeah.
that Blockbuster and BlackBerry, two Bs, are actually tragedies, right? You're talking about two massive brands. I mean, they were everywhere.
Yeah.
And both of them are extinct. I just went to blockbuster.com and it says something big is coming. Go to Sling TV. So I don't think there's, I think the brand recognizes, it's almost like Toys R Us, right? People know what Toys R Us is. They know what Blockbuster is. And so is that a tragedy? And what's the lesson learned?
No, it's not a tragedy at all. Look, things happen. What happened to Blockbuster was the 2008 financial crisis. Blockbuster had $1 billion of debt. And everyone forgets that. People don't think about, oh, yeah, Netflix was a startup and blah, blah, blah. Well, we're throwing money at Netflix because it was perceived to be, you know, a digital company. Blockbuster was brick and mortar, and they had $1 billion of debt, and the financial markets collapsed. Lehman Brothers melted down, if you remember, in 2008. Yeah. And, you know, it's impossible to, in that market condition, to be able to refinance, you know, a big debt load like that. So really, that's the story.
So hold on. And the debt was due and you had to pay it. And
oh, yeah, it was due in 2009. So it'd be like if you had a mortgage on your house, right?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you had a, let's say, a variable rate mortgage. And all of a sudden, you know, today comes and, you know, if you refinanced it 5 years ago, you were 3 years ago, you would have been fine. Today, you'd have to pay 7-8%. Yeah. Couldn't afford that. You might have to sell the house.
So Trump in 91 would have, like, too big to fail, right? So worked out with the banks. Was it Blockbuster too big to fail? Now, I don't think it's too big to fail. There's so much money with the Blackstones, the Black Rocks, you can buy anything. So Blockbuster wasn't too big to fail in a way?
No, not at all. Not at all. The lesson is relevant to everybody, big or small. You have to manage your cash flow. Debt is an opportunity to grow a company, but debt is also an opportunity to kill a company. And when conditions change, when market conditions change, there are a lot of companies out there right now, really, really good companies that loaded up with debt 4 or 5 years ago at 3%. Well, if they have to refinance that debt now at 8%, it may put them under. Now, you know, that's just a fact of life. Now, can you anticipate that? No one anticipated 3 years ago that interest rates would be where they are today. So could you fault someone for putting themselves in that position? No, not necessarily. Now, are there things you can do and should do to manage cash? Absolutely. Because cash, ultimately, that's the oxygen that a corporation needs to live. We did make it through. You asked if it was a tragedy. I'd say no, not at all. We were successful. We could have found ourselves in a situation to have to liquidate Blockbuster. We ended up with some really good strategic partners. And Dish ended up being one of those strategic partners, bought the company. They're the ones actually that closed all the stores. And I don't know, they're kind of hinting around maybe Blockbuster will be back. I'd say don't count them out yet. Dish had a very good strategy at the time that they bought Blockbuster. Now, they may have waited, delayed that strategy, but they could still bring
There's no place for Blockbuster in a retail environment. I mean, you have Redbox and people, everything is streaming now. So what place, if you had to take Blockbuster back, let's just say you, Jim, they're like, hey, you got the brand, you got the name. What do we do next?
Here's exactly what I would do. What I wanted to do back then, we called it Total Access. Now, it was Total Access across stores and kiosks and all that stuff. You don't need that today. What isn't in the market today is Total Access. In other words, you want to see, let's say you want to see the first Top Gun. Where is it? Is it on Netflix? Is it on Amazon?
Yeah, you got to Google around and then find it. Yeah,
exactly. You might not have the right subscription. Now you got to subscribe to somebody just to get that movie, Paramount Plus, whatever. No one today is the aggregator. That's what Blockbuster was. the aggregator. The reason we partnered with Dish is that they had the opportunity to aggregate, to bring content. Dish has a huge library, of course, and we were hoping that we'd be able to partner with Dish, bring that massive library of streaming content now, or of content, to the streaming market. And, you know, so is there a niche still in the streaming market that doesn't exist? Yes, absolutely. Okay,
but let me play devil's advocate here, Jim. Someone like Amazon will pay, and I've funded over 50 movies myself. So every crappy movie you saw with Bruce Willis and John Travolta, I funded, and Mel Gibson. But for the record, I had no idea of the script. I just funded them, right? But they went on Hulu. The quality of the movie wasn't as good. But companies like Hulu will pay an amount because they need content, right? And so if I'm paying a premium for that content and now all of a sudden it's on Total Access, then, you know, the reason why I have this content is to drive people to see the first Top Gun there. And yeah. So, you know, and then and these movies who need money up front will take, like, you know, here's $450,000, let's say, and we'll buy the rights to the movies, or $1 million. Now you have Blockbuster. It's say, unless you had a joint venture with the, like, you had a deal that if it's sold to, you know, like, I'm like Apple, if it's like become sort of the Apple, actually, now that I'm talking about, that'd probably be the one where if you get it directly from, it was an Amazon Prime movie, then Amazon would get 70% and then Blockbuster get 30%. Did I just figure it out while talking?
You kind of figured it out, but there's a nuance to it. There's two kinds of access to movies. There's subscription. Think of that as, so all a subscription business is the all-you-can-eat buffet, right? So you go to the all-you-can-eat buffet, is a lot of food, but it's not the highest quality food, right? Well, the a la carte menu, the fine dining, right? That's the really good stuff. So new releases are always sold a la carte. That's the Apple model. That's the Google model. We'll sell you a movie, right? The Netflix model is the subscription. You pay $19.99, whatever it is, and you get all you can eat. So what no one has provided is you take those two models and you put them together. Now you're the aggregator. You want a bunch of old movies that have been around forever? We've got the largest library of older movies for subscription, you know, $14.99 a month, whatever it is, and you can access to all those. And then if you want the best new releases, we'll offer those a la carte, by demand. That's what Blockbuster on Demand was, that piece. Blockbuster subscription would have been the all you can eat. Does that make sense?
Wouldn't there be a market for, if there's a couple of things that, if, and just correct them, we're just business master, and you and I are going to be partners. I know it. This is great. Genius. One of the great CEOs of this, and 7-Eleven is just everywhere and still going strong and such a powerful brand, more so overseas, ironically, than America. Well, how come there's not a market yet? And they tried a little bit during COVID where, like, I want to see a movie that comes out at my house, right? I don't want to go to the theater and wait for Mission Impossible and sit there. Like, I'd even pay $100, you know, to watch it at my house, so I don't have to go anywhere. Yeah. You know, I don't know what's the cap that I would pay to watch a movie, so I don't have to go to the store. But let's say $100. Why? And then Blockbuster could be Blockbuster at home, where you get the Blockbuster first. How come that market is not there? Or is it just like the AMCs and movie theaters of the world say, hey, we won't allow that. If not, we go. Or what if there was a part where they get a piece of anything at home as well? And whoever's doing that is, you know, it's just another way for revenue. Maybe it could be another idea, Jim, you and I that do together.
No, it's a good idea. I don't want to burst your bubble. It's been tested out there. The studios have dabbled in it a little bit. It's very expensive. It's a little more than $100 to see the movie you want to see.
I heard $500 on some things, right? So
yeah, it depends on the movie. But I mean, if you're a major studio and you spend $500 million or more on a movie, you've got to be pretty careful about where those windows are that you can release it. And it's always been that case. So, you know, there will be in the future that option, but today the
studio. So what are they afraid? People are just going to take clips and record it, or what are they afraid of?
Is it just, they do want to protect that in cinema experience. This is still a very big market,
which we thought was dead after COVID, that people would never go back, and movie was changed forever. And then they went back to
right. And the cinemas are getting better and better. You've got IMAX, you've got big screens, you get amazing sound. And so, you know, you probably would rather watch Top Gun in the cinema experience, for the full experience of Top Gun. But eventually, You know, I'll see it online or at home.
I see everything on the plane.
It's coming.
I see everything on the plane.
Yeah, I know.
I wait till they go on the plane so I don't get bored on my flights to Australia. So, Jim, how come there hadn't there been a licensing deal, maybe with an audio company or home in theater store, like, you know, Blockbuster Speakers or Blockbuster Home in Theater? It's a great name. I mean, it's probably the one. So why not? Was that ever discussed or thought of, that maybe there was a licensing deal to that?
Yeah, there's a we had looked at in the past a lot of different licensing opportunities. Probably the best, and it wasn't really a licensing, but it was close, was a partnership that we were really close to getting with Google, where we would have had up on Google a Blockbuster on demand experience with everything. If you imagine side by side, YouTube, everything free, Blockbuster, everything paid. So anytime you've got actors, actresses, professional film, Blockbuster. Anytime it's amateur, YouTube. That was a marriage made in heaven with Google. We were this close.
Oh,
my board of directors actually signed it. Yeah. The reason Google walked away from the deal at the last minute is rumors were circulating. They weren't true, but they were rumors at the time. Hit the LA press that Blockbuster is about to file for bankruptcy. And, you know, that deal would have negated any reason.
Oh, no, it'd be a $100+ billion company today.
Yeah.
And after you leave, what year did you leave Blockbuster, and what did you do next?
After Blockbuster,
What year was that?
I stayed with them for a while. I stayed with Dish as an advisor to the company for the transition. I think we ended up filing in around 2009 or 10. Blockbuster bought the company out of a restructuring, and I stayed for about 2 years till about 2011, 12, something like that.
And then what did you do after that?
Next step, I had been working with a company called, bought into a brand called Wild Oats, that we, natural organic food brand, was the largest competitor to Whole Foods. We took that to Walmart. Was very promising opportunity, but Walmart decided to go private label instead. So kind of took the wind out of our sails a little bit on that. It's still out there. The brand is still out there, and potentially a good natural and organic brand that we're looking for a home for. I also have been involved in a lot of startups. It's kind of fun now to help young companies get started. So I've been doing that. I've got a rocket company out of California I'm helping them build. Former SpaceX guys that are building a Starship, in effect, the next jumbo rocket to be able to go to low Earth orbit with massive numbers of either passengers or satellites.
Wow. And now, obviously, you're an author. Is it education is freedom, right?
Education is freedom, yeah.
I have to ask you, from a marketing and branding perspective myself.
Yeah.
I mean, I have all the names. The guy who's been around with like 7-Eleven and Blockbuster, education is freedom. It's like, I don't know. On one hand, I'm just playing the devil's advocate.
Oh, I know. Yeah, I
no
agree.
Shit, Sherlock. Or people would say the education we're getting now, what the teachers are teaching, and indoctrination and wokeness and all that. And so talk to us about this book and this latest project of yours, and explain to us. I have to say, when I saw it, I was like, know about the name, but
it doesn't trip off the tongue. I'll tell you how I found the name. I was walking across campus, Columbia University, going back to teach a class. I think I was CFO of 7-Eleven at the time, or something like that. I'm all dude'd up. I got a suit and a tie, and I'm feeling pretty proud of myself, you know, because when I was there, I was dirt poor, you know, living on the Upper West Side, starving to death. And I was one of those kids that never should have gone to school. Nobody in my family did, you know, never dreamed I'd be graduating from, you know, Columbia University Business School. So on my way back, I run into this kid, African-American kid, arm full of books, T-shirt, looked like hell, looked like he had been up all night. Education is freedom on his T-shirt. Stopped me in my tracks. I was like, damn, you know, shook his hand. Dude, that's me. You know, I wouldn't be here but for that. That is why I'm here. And, oh, and by the way, you know what? That's a wake-up call, because I thought I was done, but, man, I got a lot more to learn. I'm about to be named CEO of this Fortune 500 company, and I've got more to learn. So I grabbed that name, created a foundation 20 years ago by that same name, and here's the reason for the book. Two people need it. kids need it. There are so many kids out there that should go to college or should make the best of their opportunity, and they don't. They're like, there's no opportunity. I'll never make it. Not true. If I could do it, anybody could do it. So education is freedom is a message to those kids, and I got a roadmap in it.
So let me play devil's advocate again.
Yeah.
The education system, a lot of, you saw what's happening in Harvard now and all the people, like, it's just,
yeah.
You know, here's a story to put this in perspective. I have a friend. He homeschooled his daughter, right? Yeah. Very driven. She's A++, did all this extracurricular activity, perfect GPA, goes to Harvard, right? Which is ultimately the dream.
Yeah.
And he goes, after 3 years of Harvard, you know, decides to go in a completely different direction. Turns out to be woke, idealist, like just not the person he had there as well. Then on the other hand, I just started a trade school where, you know, there's such a lack that, I mean, it's the future of like HVAC plumbers, electrician, just nobody wants to do it. And they're going to become six figures jobs, high paying jobs, because there's a lack thereof, because everybody wants to be on YouTube, which most of them don't make any money. And they do two videos, they didn't go viral, and then they say it sucks.
Yeah.
And if you had talked to most people today, they will say that the education they got, unless you're an engineer or a doctor, right, is not what it should be anymore. That they probably learn more from this podcast than you and I are doing. Or if I sat down with you, I'd learn a lot more. So explain to me how you think this is in today's world.
So there's two things. First, I'm gonna share with you the tagline, which is the future's in your hands, right? And that's a message to the kids that, like, you know what? Don't listen to all the noise out there. Your future really is up to you. Yes, you can be a plumber and you can make $60 an hour, but in 30 years, you might be making 70. Be careful, because there's huge demand today. I don't know where that demand may be tomorrow. You know, you just don't know. And that's the challenge with trades. I was one of those kids. I could have gone to Hamburger U. You know, McDonald's wanted me. They're like,
you would have been the CEO. You know, you would have been the CEO, Jim.
I probably would have been the CEO. Yeah. But what if? You know, if I took one baby step outside of that vertical, I'd be toast. Because here's what it comes down to. It's differentiation. Where you go to school is your brand. And when you're in the market, even if you want to be an entrepreneur, you got to borrow money, right? What do the banks look at? Show me your resume. So, there's a narrative
out there. Could you have a better book title? It would have been like, you can be anything you want to be.
And that is the message in the book.
I understand, Jim, but you know as well as I know, if I don't like the cover, I'm just like, for example, like, I know that's the foundation you put in there.
Yeah.
And I'm like, there's no way. Like, and first I thought it would be like some idealist manifesto about society and educational reform, like you position it, right? So people hear this, and I think everyone who's listening to this needs to get this book to send it to their children.
Yes. But,
you know, it's kind of like, it's all about marketing, right? And at the end of the day,
yeah.
I mean, people get it because you're the former CEO of Blockbuster and 7-Eleven, not because of the title. If it was anybody else but you, I don't know how I would feel about it.
But, that, you're absolutely right, and I'm a marketing guy. That's what I'm doing this podcast for, because the other message behind education is freedom is not for the kids. It's for the parents. It's for me and you, because we are toast as a society. If we don't change this narrative, because I know it's frustrating. I don't like rumors of indoctrination, or I don't like all the noise that's in the market about books and banning this and teachers unions. But the reality is America today is on this kind of decline in our post-secondary education. We're not even in the top 10 industrialized nations in college graduations. Yeah, we need plumbers. We need all these other trades. But if we don't catch up in this information age where AI and all these other things are taking over, if we don't catch up with highly educated post-secondary degrees, the rest of the world is going to pass us by. So we've got to be competitive. And then just for our democracy to survive, going all the way back to Jefferson and the founding fathers said that education really is the foundation. It's a prerequisite for democracy to be surviving. A stable democracy has to have an educated populace. And if we're going in the wrong direction there, democracy itself is in jeopardy. So it's a lofty title, but that's why. That's the purpose.
So on a one way, you are very outgoing, enthusiastic, but you're also an intellectual, seeing how big the size of those books are back there as well. How important you think is that people not necessarily read or look at the source or the history, that we will form our opinion based on what somebody says on a 30-second clip? And to be honest with you, if the former CEO of Blockbuster says something about business, right, the majority of people be like, oh, wow, that must be it. And the other one's like, well, I went out of business, why would I listen to him? Which is obviously right. So yeah, but the majority of people, it's like, and that's why I had you, like, to be honest with you, you're not the former CEO of Blockbuster and you have a book called Education is Freedom. You have zero chance of getting on. Not because you're not the greatest speaker. It's like, okay, like, you know, so it's kind of like your past is your prerequisite to get inside the door to say, okay, now here's my message.
Yeah.
Why these big books, and what's your knowledge base on there? I see you're very patriotic. You're very aviation enthusiast. I mean, I don't need to go to your office. I know exactly how you are just by looking at that office.
Yeah. It's kind of a museum back there. Yeah. Yeah. I'm an aviator, but here's the key. I put in there, I call it C-suite learnings, and we've forgotten as a society, or we're not doing, probably because of the convenience of information. There's so much, like you said, on here, the sound bites, you know, we can get lazy, but there are fundamentals we all learn in grammar school. Critical thinking, you know, the old Socratic method, asking why, taking both sides of an argument. Creativity is something that you don't see a lot. We're so technical now that when someone uses the right side of their brain and gets creative, when, I dare to use an example, but when some creative person at Anheuser-Busch goes off on a tangent, right? Whoa, smash that one to death, right? Because
let me ask on that. As a CEO,
yeah,
what was the right move? You tried something. I'm sure their point was,
yeah,
you know, why? I don't know. But because you take a look at your demographic, I know you're trying to get new people, but was that really going to get people to do a beer? But regardless, the CEO, and I know what he did, right away, right? There was like denial, defending, and stuff like that. What would you have done as CEO if that happened?
You know, there is and no.
By the, do you think the CEO approved it? Like, do you really think, would that have come on your desk, you think?
Never, never in a million years. You know, this is the thing. Unless you've been in the chair with 400,000 employees and they're out there doing the best they can do to try to expand market share. And that's what they were doing. They were trying to expand market share. But, you know, the beer business is very competitive. So anything you can do to get, you know, another 0.5% out there with a different demographic, you know, I don't know, would the CEO have turned that down? Probably, if he saw it, but you can't see everything. So someone was a little too creative. But the scary
should they come and say, listen, I'm sorry it offended you. We apologize. Because he's sort of like, it would have made a difference in today. It used to be in the old days. If you made a mistake, hey, I made a mistake, I'm sorry. But now they just use it against you. And, you know, talk that to get political, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, what the Colorado Supreme Court did, all it did, I mean, the guy hasn't been found guilty yet, right? So it's not like he was guilty and then you decide to do that. Okay, he's not even found guilty yet. And all you just did is divided the nation, created more hate. If you love him, you dig down deep. If you hate him, you're cheering. And people in the middle go, what a shit show that is.
That's exactly the reason for the lofty title. Education really is the antidote to fear. Because think about all this stuff. Think about all the.
But how do you know you get the right education? Because education to you, what you give people may be different to somebody else's definition.
Education is learning. Learning knowledge is the light. It's when you're a little kid, right? And you're scared. Hey, mom, there's a monster under the bed. Starts screaming. Mom comes in, turns on the light. You look under the bed. I didn't have anything to be afraid of. There's no monster, no boogeyman, right? That's what knowledge is. That's what critical thinking is all about. Really putting the light on a subject before we get all worked up about it, because you're right. And this country is getting torn apart now because a lot of people have tapped into the reality, the lowest common denominator, which is fear. What this country needs is hope. What builds hope is knowledge. So we've got to take this cycle. I actually put two cycles in the book. One that is ignorance, fear, hate, violence. We see a lot of that in the world, right? And it starts with ignorance. It causes fear. and then causes violence and causes, you know, anger and violence. You can reverse that with knowledge instead of ignorance. And that leads to understanding, which leads to hope, which leads to peace ultimately. So, and we have had leaders in our past, you know, Ronald Reagan, JFK, we had people that channeled that kind of hope and didn't use fear as a weapon, you know, or as a lever to get elected. So as a country, I think that's what my book is a call to action, that we can be better than this, but we have to use knowledge as a base and a common denominator for Americans. The more knowledgeable we are, instead of just taking at face value stuff we see on a meme and going, oh yeah, and then copying it, right? The more knowledgeable we are, the better we are.
Last question. What's next for you? I know the book comes out on February 27th. If you ever listen to this interview, as it'll live forever, but it's on Amazon. And if it's after February 27th, 2024, you can get it anytime. I'm in the future. I think everyone should get it. One, because obviously how you change is how you succeed, and taking maybe resetting the foundational basis of what life is all about, what education is all about, what values are all about. And also not only just solving the symptoms of the problem, but maybe this book goes back to the root cause of many of the problems that society faces today, both on a personal, a business, and a corporate level. And you may not change the world, but if you can change yourself and then impact the environment of your children and your grandchildren and pass on, or the people around you, that's how we're going to change by an ecosystem, because obviously that's what success is all about. So what's next for you?
What's next for me is simple answer, whatever I want. Oof. Here's why.
Every day, education is freedom.
Yeah, it's so simple. Every day for me is a new adventure. I get up, I can go fly an airplane, I can go, you know, paint a picture, I can write some music, I can do anything I want to do. And if I want to go be a doctor right now and help people, I've kind of got the secret to that. It'll take me about 5 to 8 years, and I can go put my head down and do that if I want to. I probably won't do that, but
no, that's
but the point is.
But what are you working on?
I know now? I can do anything I want to do.
I know you can do it, but what are you doing now?
What am I doing now? Yeah. The thing that, well, right now, I want to spread the word. Most important for me, given where society is right now and given so many kids that need, you know, a roadmap, that's my mission right now. For business, what do I want to do? I'm fascinated with space, commercial space, the new, what they're calling the new spaces, because Musk and Bezos created really an entire industry of needs.
Yeah, I went to Blue Origin. It was pretty impressive.
It's so exciting. There's such exciting stuff. And, you know, and I think that's the kind of thing that will inspire people. I was inspired by the Apollo program as a kid. I was like, man, I got to study. I want to be one of those astronauts, you know? So if we can inspire with the space program, with the cool stuff that Elon Musk is doing and Jeff Bezos and NASA. NASA's doing some cool stuff today. I think that's what's exciting. Part of my personal adventure.
Well, by how old are you, Jim? Because you have a lot of energy, but you've been around a long time, but you don't look that old. So,
well, thank you. Yeah. I'm frighteningly old. I used to be like the youngest guy in the room, and now all of a sudden,
what's the number, Jim? Because here's the thing too. I have to say, you got to be over 70, but you don't look that. You look like 58, 60.
Yeah, I'm in my 60s. Yeah.
I don't know. I just because there's so much experience been around for so long, so it's kind of like. I was doing the math. Yeah, you don't look. You have a lot of energy and enthusiasm and passion. And what you're doing is taking what's inside your brain and trying to basically not reprogram, but empower people to say, "Hey, listen, look at everything." And I think once you do that, that's when freedom comes. And freedom comes from liberation of other people's opinions and idealizations and force feed. Freedom comes from taking that education yourself, looking at both sides of every issue, coming up to a conclusion. And in living by the principles that you have set up, not what somebody else has fit out. And that's what Jim has done very well. I haven't read the book because I didn't get an advanced copy of the book, but I will be the first one. I actually bought it while we were on the phone. So while you were on there. So if anybody saw me on my phone, I bought it. I was like, you know, why not? And you should too as well. So you can be first as well. And I encourage everybody, first of all, to like, follow, share, subscribe. It doesn't cost anything. Leave a comment. Share, reach out to Jim. He's got a Instagram account, Jim Keys, Or just Google the title of the book and you can find it there.
Jakey's author.
Jakey's author. But also if you Google Jim's name, his Instagram pops up, because I just did that before the show as well. Phenomenal information. I truly hope this will not be the last time, but one of many series, because you know, every time we're going to talk, it's going to be something different as well. And Jim did it yesterday. He did it today. He's doing it tomorrow. And this is a man who could have just sort of flown into the horizon and done whatever he's want, but he decided to take a detour so that you can be empowered, so that he can cement your own legacy. And I think education is freedom. And that's Jim Keyes. Jim, you have the final word.
You said it best. I can't add much to it. I guess, you know, just to add to that, I am a lousy golfer, so I've got to go do something else.
I do drive 375 yards, but golf is about 4 consecutive shots, and that's a whole different story for another day. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.